I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. PBS's History Detectives will begin its summertime program tomorrow at 7 o'clock, and it will run through September. If you haven't seen this program, it's the stories, the small history behind big history. It's the stories, and they're very... They're all over the place, these stories. Somebody has what they think may be something valuable that relates to a big or a minor event in American history, but it's history nonetheless. So it's history with a small h. And the summer series opener sets the stage for some of the most historically significant milestones that we're marking this year. And certainly we're doing that on this program, the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War and also the 70th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. History Detectives has been on the air for some time, and one of the History Detectives is our guest this hour. Wes Cowan is president and principal auctioneer of Cowan's Auctions in Cincinnati, Ohio. He's an internationally recognized expert in historic Americana, and also he is a featured appraiser on the Antiques Roadshow, a show that's a favorite of many. He writes a monthly antiques column for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Antique Week, Collectors News, and the Antiquing Journal. He's a requested speaker at antiques events around the country. He is a native of Louisville, Kentucky, and he grew up in a household filled with Victorian antiques, nurtured by a mother who likes all things old. After receiving his doctorate, he taught in the anthropology department of Ohio State University and assumed the post of curator of archaeology at the Cincinnati Museum of Natural History. He has published widely, and we're delighted to have him with us this hour. If you have, I think this would be appropriate for calls, if you have something that you think may be historically significant and you can tell us the story somewhat concisely, we'd love to hear from you today. Or if you're a fan of the show, we'd love to hear from you as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Wes.
Kathleen, good morning.
Good morning, Wes. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You know, it's an amazing journey. People have what seems to be a very small thing that they've wondered about for years and years, and it leads to this big event in history sometimes. It's kind of a wonderful thing, isn't it, that we can learn history this way?
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head in your introduction, and this is something that I've been harping for a number of years, that the reason why History Detectives has been so successful is that we cash in, if you will, on Americans' love of history. But it's not the history that we get in our college courses and our high school survey courses, which I refer to as history with a big H. This history of America with this broad, sweeping paintbrush, but rather history with a little h is what we're interested in as Americans. And history with a little h relates directly to individual families. We all have things in our homes that were passed down to us from one of our ancestors, whether it's a chair or a painting or a Civil War sword or a shoebox full of letters from World War II. All of the most Americans, anyway, have these items, and they relate their particular family to larger events in American history. But their story is that personal, small, little h story that relates in back to history with a big H.
Do you think that we need to incorporate more of that little h history into our college classrooms?
Well, I think not only college, but I think that high school and grade school. I think that any way that we can get Americans engaged in learning about the history of their country, the better citizen they'll be. And one way might be to make sure that these stories are being told and incorporated and utilized in classrooms.
How many calls, letters, emails do you get from people who watch the show, who have something in their house, and how many of those ideas do you use for programs?
Well, I should say that the History Detectives website, that's the principal avenue in which story ideas are channeled into PBS. And it's my understanding that about 8,000 or more ideas Ooh. Get sent in every year to the History Detectives website. And there's a place where you can do this. Do you have a story that you'd like to be told? And about 8,000 of those come across the come across their doorstep, I think, every year. Naturally, not all of those are selected, and in fact, I would guess that the majority of them can be weeded out pretty quickly, that they just won't make good television, or it's a story that just won't work, but that's where they get. That's where they go, 8,000 to the History Detectives website.
And when it gets to you or one of the other detectives, it can take you to some far-flung places, can't it?
Well, that's right. We each story is in development for anywhere from a month to 6 weeks, and sometimes longer. And the production company, Lion Television in New York, and then Oregon Public Broadcasting, their partner in Portland, have teams of researchers that are investigating stories and do a lot of the legwork before the decision is made to begin filming. Once the decision is made, each shoot takes a week. We generally travel for 2 days and then film for 3 days. So 5 days of production and about 6 weeks of research go into every shoot.
Why don't you tell us, because it really took you to places that you probably knew nothing about. I'm not sure how much you knew about stunt riders and saddles, but your piece Tomorrow is one that's featured, and it's on a saddle for a stunt rider who was fairly important in the film world.
Absolutely, and honestly, it's a great story about a stunt rider. Began first his career as a rodeo performer, Yakima Canutt. And Yak Canutt, I had never heard of this guy. You know, who's Yakima Canutt?
Right.
Everybody's seen a rodeo, but who's Yakima Canutt? Well, as it turns out, Yakima Canutt was sort of the grandfather of the Hollywood stuntman. After his career as a rodeo performer was over, he moved to Hollywood and he did some of the most amazing stunts that we all know in film. Yakima Canutt was behind, and that story took me to California, to Idaho, to Oregon, and it was a great story. And it was about a guy that I knew nothing about, and as you'll see, as the viewers will see, we had a pretty good outcome at the end of that story. Now, I'm not going to tell you what the outcome was, because if I did that, then you wouldn't watch the show tomorrow night.
And I won't tell either. I've seen a preview of the show, but I won't tell either, so you can watch tomorrow. The other two pieces feature what will be a focus during this season, because we have the huge event, which is a commemoration of the start of the Civil War 150 years ago. I would imagine that there will be a lot of segments that deal with that, because there is so much collecting of artifacts relating to the Civil War.
Well, I think that's right. But collecting aside, the Civil War is arguably one of the seminal events in the history of our country, mm-hmm. and continues to affect our country today. And I think that you will see a number of stories that revolve around the Civil War. I was involved in three, I know, so the other detectives I know also were involved with some. But, yeah, you're going to see a lot about the Civil War during the 150th anniversary year.
Do you want to tell us about one that you were associated with?
Well, you know, I can talk about two.
Okay.
One involved something that happened before the Civil War, and that was John Brown's 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, on the U.S. arsenal there, in which he and a number of his followers attempted to take over the arsenal and extract weapons from the arsenal to use for a slave rebellion that he felt would end slavery. As part of John Brown's plan to do this, he contracted with a blacksmith to make pikes that he felt that he would use initially to arm slaves with, and he ordered, he commissioned 1,000 pikes from a dealer, and boy, now I'm going to blow it here, but I think it was in Massachusetts or Connecticut, and he had these shipped to a hideout near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, and as it turns out, very few were actually used during the quote-unquote rebellion, because it failed, of course. But in the aftermath of the raid, these pikes became a symbol that were used both by abolitionists in the North who wanted to show that these are the symbol of let's free the slaves and end slavery, and then, of course, they were also used by slaveholders and politicians in the South who were saying, you know, look, this is what some people want to do to our form of life here. But the story involved a pike that was found by a guy in northern Ohio in an antique shop about 10 years ago, and he always wondered, could this be a John Brown pike?
Oh.
And our story set about trying to discover, was this really one of John Brown's pikes? And again, I'm not going to tell you how it turned out,
okay.
Because it's a twisted story. But, gosh, I got to go to all these places and interview amazing people that related to the story of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. And as part of that, I was able to, at the National Park Service Museum at Harper's Ferry, actually hold in my hand a Sharps carbine, which is a rifle, that was used by John Brown himself at Harper's Ferry on the raid. And it was the most amazing thing to hold this incredible relic in my hands.
Isn't this something? So you obviously have been changed by doing this program.
Oh, so, yeah. There's no question about it. I tell people all the time that, and I don't think that I'm just talking for myself. I think that the other detectives would echo this too. We all feel incredibly privileged to be able to be invited into someone's home who we don't know. They're a complete stranger. They have a problem, a question that they want answered. They've asked us to help, and then we get to go out and visit places and go behind the scenes and interview people that the average American would love to be able to do,
mm-hmm.
but they can't because of various circumstances. And we get to do that for them, and I would say, yes, it has been a life-changing experience for me.
Oh, that's great.
And by the way, the show, this is the ninth season, the end of the ninth season. So
remarkable.
We've been on a long time.
Yes. You said, I was listening to an interview with you, and I believe that you said the Manhattan Project was one of the most interesting pieces that you have done. Am I right about that?
Yeah. You know, after 9 years, you don't remember all the stories that you've done. Personally think that, like most Americans that are bombarded with too much information now, you know, we tend to carry around only that information that continues to remain relevant. But the Manhattan Project, I've done two stories on the Manhattan Project over the course of History Detectives, and they were very memorable. One of them involved a scientist who was working in the Columbia office of the Manhattan, Columbia University office of the Manhattan Project, and after the Manhattan Project was over, he became a professor at SUNY Stony Brook, and the story took us to his house out on Long Island. It was a beautiful spring day. I remember we were filming with him in his backyard, beautiful, shady backyard. And, you know, I asked him, as people often do, to people who were involved in the Manhattan Project, so when the bomb was dropped, what did the scientists think about this awesome unleashing of this weapon that was capable of mass destruction? I mean, was there a sense of regret? What did you guys think? And without hesitation, he said, no. The first thing we thought was we didn't know how close we were. We knew we were all working on a bomb, but because the Manhattan Project was so compartmentalized across the country that no one place, the scientists in one university or one research lab didn't know how close they were. He said that we were surprised that it happened because nobody knew how close it was. But then we all felt, the second emotion was, this is great because it just allowed us to end the war sooner, which is, of course, what Truman was saying when the bomb was dropped, that we didn't have to invade Japan. And at that point, the camera turned off, and it was one of those situations where you say, God, why can't you keep the camera running? But the camera was turned off, and he had paused, and he looked up at me, and he said, but, you know, we did have one really great regret. And I said, what was that? And he said, well, many of us really wished that the government had continued the Manhattan Project, spending all this money on the project, because we never solved the one problem that we all knew was going to be a problem, and that was what to do with nuclear waste. And we all felt like that if we just continued this crash work, we could have figured this out. And boy, that hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, here's something that in the 40s the scientific community knew was going to be a problem, and it's still a problem with us today.
Right, and you had all those brilliant minds concentrating their brilliant minds on this issue. Perhaps something could have been discovered.
Well, there's no question about that, and then just really briefly, and I'll touch on this only for a second because it shows you the scope of the project. The other story I did involved Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and what was going on in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And this was an enormous part of the project. At the height of the Manhattan Project, 10% of all the electricity in the country was being consumed by the Oak Ridge plant.
Whoa!
10% of all the electricity in the country. That'll show you the scale of the project.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in just a moment. Wes Cowan is our guest. He is one of the history detectives. The show, the PBS show, starts its new season tomorrow, a new night for them, 7 p.m. Central Time, and it will continue through September. They have a special focus this season on significant historical milestones, the 150th anniversary of the Civil War and the 70th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Wes has been with the show for some time. He is also president and principal auctioneer of Collins Auctions in Cincinnati, Ohio. He is a recognized expert in historic Americana, and he also is a featured appraiser on Antiques Roadshow, the wildly popular PBS program. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Considering that most of the suggestions for the program come from the website for the History Detectives, you may have something you believe is of historical value. And let's make sure that our calls take that route, you know, historical value in your house and you've always wondered about. Or we can talk about the idea of learning the big history through the small history, and if we need to go more in that direction. Some of you have seen some of the programs and you found certain segments particularly fascinating. You can talk about those. We'd like to hear from you. Again, the number 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wes Cowan is our guest, one of the detectives on History Detectives, PBS program now in its ninth season. Beginning tomorrow, it starts its new season, 7 o'clock Central Time. And we welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Dean in New London is our first caller. Hi, Dean.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Dean.
Hi. let me turn my radio down.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'm a retired history teacher, and one thing that I learned through about 30 years of teaching history is that kids don't like history because they don't have any. And I would hope that this program would be required watching for all young people.
So you know, that's very interesting because we actually, a lot of our fans are high school history teachers and junior high school history teachers. But I would argue that kids do have history. They've got plenty of history. Their families have history. They may not know it, but I'll guarantee you that their parents have something in the house that was handed down to an ancestor. And that those objects, those letters, those photo albums from World War II or whatever, those are historical objects. And they can be used by students as windows into the past to learn about their family, their family's involvement in the bigger, or history with the big H. And they can be useful tools.
I would hope so, but I just really am afraid that kids are not learning history the way they should. It's not about a bunch of dates and dead people.
Right. No, it certainly isn't.
It's about people living, and what today is going to be history tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to pay attention to that, because if we don't, we're going to make the same mistakes again.
Well, that's quite correct. But I do think that, and bear with me, because I haven't really clearly thought this through, but every time I hear people complaining that kids don't learn history the way they used to, I'm not sure that when I was 13 or 14 or 15, I was learning history like I was supposed to be learning, or what a teacher thought I was supposed to be learning either. That's sort of a moving target to me. I think we need to find what new ways to involve kids with the past, and certainly telling stories is one way to do that.
Thank you so much, Dean, for the call. I think one of the only, I must have had others, but the one that stays in my mind, I was taking my son to look at colleges, and I, of course, thinking that he wanted to be a Lincoln Scholar because his mother loves Lincoln, went to Knox College. Of course, he doesn't want to be a Lincoln Scholar. He wants to be a baseball announcer. But we went to Knox where the final Lincoln-Douglas debate took place, and we were in the room, you know, where they tried to tell you about the school, and it was for alumni, and the guide said, "That's an interesting chair. You may want to sit in it, one of you or some of you, and I'll tell you about it later." So I sat down, and at the end of the time, she said that was the chair that Abraham Lincoln sat. It still gives me goosebumps. Abraham Lincoln sat in for the final Lincoln-Douglas debate, and I just went, "Oh, my gosh," out loud. Isn't this something? There is something about sitting in his chair. So I understand this whole business of having an object or being sitting in a chair that George Washington sat in or Abraham Lincoln, that it fills you with a sense of awe.
Well, I think that's right. And you just as easily could have been a person whose great-great-grandfather had been at a Lincoln campaign rally and was given or bought or somehow acquired a silk ribbon that he pinned on to his lapel that had Abraham Lincoln for president on the ribbon, and then the family kept that. Those stories can be replicated by the hundreds of thousands in our country.
Yes. And then what does it get you doing? Learning more about the debates, learning more about the president, learning about the time.
That's exactly right. That's the window. It's that little object that provides the window into the past.
Yeah. Brent in Maquoneago. Hi.
Hi. Great show. I heard a rumor years ago in referencing the Manhattan Project that the scientists involved, maybe all of them on the project, and maybe just the ones involved in the initial test, you know, explosion, weren't sure how continuous or far the chain reaction was going to go. In other words, I've heard a rumor that the whole, that the atmosphere of the whole planet, they were fearing that the whole planet, you know, could ignite. And I just wondered if that rumor or whatever was true.
I've heard that, too. I don't know where it came from, but I've heard it, too.
And I can't answer that question. The only thing that I could say, that I can say, is that it was an enormous project and that it was very compartmentalized, and that not because there was a plant in, there was research being done at Columbia, there was research being done at the University of Chicago, there was research being done at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Los Alamos, New Mexico, and then in Hanford, Washington. So there were, it was an enormous project in scale and spread out throughout the country. But my guess is that because it was all so new, that from a theoretical standpoint, the people that were involved with the chain reaction, were making sure the chain reaction was going to happen, they could project pretty well what would likely happen, but there was a lot of uncertainty. So it may be that there were millions of, not millions, but dozens of questions that they weren't able to answer until it actually, they started doing real on-the-ground tests.
Thank you, Brent, so much for your call. Let's go to Dick in Waukesha. Hi, Dick.
Hi.
Hi.
My story ties in with what the previous caller was talking about, the human interest story. In 1955, my family and I lived in Gaylord, Michigan, which is about 65 miles south of the Straits of Mackinac, if that helps.
Way up north.
And we sang in a church choir, and there was a young man there who we got acquainted with and enjoyed, and he invited us to go to his folks' cottage on Otsego Lake, 5 miles south of town, and his parents were Dr. and Mrs. Compton, Arthur Compton, and he was a scientist, and he worked in Tennessee, I think, and I think they wrote a book about this, but he told us about the experiment in, I think it was Stagg Field, under the stands in Stagg Field at the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they did. He told that story. They didn't know for sure what was going to happen. But they had arranged a code that if things worked out, why Dr. Fermi was to call Dr. Compton up at his cottage on Otsego Lake. And this is what happened. The phone rang, and Dr. Compton picked up the phone, and it was Fermi, and he said, "The Italian navigator has landed."
Huh.
And Dr. Compton said, "And were the natives friendly?" "Yes."
Oh.
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense. I'm sure that a lot of that was information was being transmitted in code to the scientists involved. You know, it's an amazing story, and perhaps the most amazing person involved with that was Leslie Grove, the general who actually was in charge of the project in terms of, you know, making sure that it all got done and corralling all the scientists, and you know, I think it's a great story.
Thank you so much. Quite a memory, Dick. We go next to Pete in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Hi.
When I was younger, my dad had a picture of, he was in the Navy in World War II, and I seen a picture that was, and now it's lost, of course, of a submarine and a gun sight. And he was on a tanker ship that was the first one into Pearl Harbor after it was bombed. Would that submarine, would that have been that, the only one that had been captured that's at the Science and Industry Museum in Chicago?
So your question is, involves a Japanese sub that was involved in the Pearl Harbor invasion or the Pearl Harbor attack?
No. He had a picture of it, of one in his gun sight. And, in a gun sight that, because he was on a tanker.
Okay.
But he had this picture of a submarine in a gun sight. And I was just kind of wondering, because I thought that was the only one that was captured. There was only one that was captured.
Only one Japanese submarine.
Is that what it was?
Asking you. Is that I think there were probably more than one submarine that was probably captured. But I'm not familiar with the story that you're relating. I know that there were Japanese submarines involved with Pearl Harbor, and I seem to recall something about a Japanese submarine that was captured that was involved with Pearl Harbor. But I'm not sure about this. Maybe some of our listeners can chime in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pete, very much for your call. Here's an email from Donna in Sturgeon Bay. During World War II, my mother saved most of the letters she received from my four brothers who were in the service at that time. I kept them 2 years ago. My children and I put them into four separate albums. We are happy with the results, but ultimately, what do we do with them? My thought goes to donating them to the county library. Should we be thinking of anything else?
You know, on the Antiques Roadshow, I probably see more World War II things. I generally sit at the photography table, and so people bring in photo albums, they bring in letters. I tend to get a lot of World War II material at the Roadshow. And what I tell people about these sorts of archives is that they should not split them up among family members, but they should try to keep them together, and that most county or state historical societies or university libraries have special collections that they would welcome these archives as additions to. I would think that the Wisconsin Historical Society
yes.
in Madison would love to have this sort of archive. It's a type of archive that traditionally I think has been neglected among historical societies, but is now becoming more and more important. So I would contact the Wisconsin Historical Society or your county historical society, but make sure, and this is the thing that I caution people about, local historical societies. Make sure that historical society has the resources to take care of your archives in perpetuity. And a lot of them don't. So my first choice is generally a state archive.
Mm-hmm. And they're doing one whippersnapper of a job with Civil War material now, putting it all online. So you can find out from the Wisconsin Historical Society what the story was for each of the 90,000 soldiers in the Civil War from Wisconsin. I just think that's incredible.
Well, and the Wisconsin Historical Society is one of the great historical societies in the country with great collections, great staff, and unfortunately, like most historical societies in all 50 states, they're underfunded.
Way underfunded. I know they've just started a big capital campaign. We got to keep that alive. I mean, if we don't fund our history, for heaven's sake.
Absolutely.
How will we ever know what happened? I'm stating the obvious, but you got to know what happened. We go next to Wendy from Oconomowoc. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I don't know that this would really make a great TV show, but my grandfather was a medical doctor in the Army from 1914 after World War II, and he wrote all sorts of anecdotal books while he was officer of the day that kind of tells about the VA Medical Center,
oh.
the Wood, Wisconsin Medical VA.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes with the, he talks about the history. Now, I don't think he researched all that himself. He researched it, but I don't think he's the one that found the information. He compiled information, but I'm working on editing this book now because his typewriter didn't have spell check. So that I was wondering if it's got a lot of personal stories about the people, and some of them actually are somewhat dramatic. And
your story is a great story because it typifies, it's exactly what I've contended all along, that people have these stories. Sounds like they haven't been published yet, right?
No. They had a bookbinding thing at the VA, and he had them self-bound, you know, for himself.
Right, so they're his typed pages, his personal reminiscences.
And he also had a box full of old pictures, some of which look like they were before automobiles.
Wow. See, I'm not sure that this is a history detective story because it sounds to me like you don't have a real question that you want answered. You've got it all right there at your fingertips. But, again, it's the kind of archive that the Wisconsin Historical Society would love to include in their collections.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Wendy, for the call. An email that's come in, Wes, the submarine that's at the Museum of Science and Industry is the U-505 and is German, not Japanese.
Gotcha. Okay,
right.
Good.
Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning. I was teaching Rosebud Indian Reservation in the middle 1970s, and Lloyd One Star Sr. was my principal. He was the Indian that took the first scalp in the movie A Man Called Horace with Richard Harris. He also authored a book in Lakota language, and I took that course in Lakota language under him. I had him autograph my book, and he put a statement in there as to what he did in the movie A Man Called Horse. He was the leader of the Gullah Sioux.
Sure.
And I've still got that book today. I have no idea what it's worth. I've kept it as a keepsake.
Well, I would say that it's probably worth more to you as a keepsake than it is than there is any great historical value to it. I would think that his autograph would be a relatively minor autograph. If you had Sitting Bull's autograph, for example, his autograph, and he signed a number of things, is quite valuable. But most contemporary persons, their autographs are not of a great value.
Thanks, Eugene, very much. But it will be, I know, because I know a little bit about Eugene. I'm sure that it's very valuable to you. Dave in Menominee, hi.
Hi, thank you. Last year sometime I saw a public television documentary called Enemy in Our Midst, and it was about the Nazi prisoner of war camps that we had here in the United States. There were over 650 camps that we had where we held the Nazis, and there were four of them up here in the Upper Peninsula. Where they held them out in the middle of the woods. They, you know, did logging, they worked, and most of them fell in love with the country and ended up becoming citizens. The filmmakers from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I just wanted to get to any comments from your guest on any knowledge he has on something like that.
Well, I'm not knowledgeable about the ones in Wisconsin, although it doesn't surprise me that there were. There were prisoner of war camps everywhere. I grew up in at least my relatives in western Kentucky, in a little county called Union County, Kentucky, in the middle of nowhere. There was a German prisoner of war camp there. So they were all over the country. I know that we've investigated these. At least one story was done on the site of a prisoner of war camp in Texas. I know that there have been stories over the years on History Detectives about artwork that were done by prisoners of war. So we've looked at this, and it's a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dave, very much for your call. We need to pause for just a moment and return. Wes Cowan is our guest this hour of the program, History Detectives, moving to a new night, and it's tomorrow and time, 7 o'clock Central Time on PBS. And one of the focuses of this season will be the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War and the 70th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. There will be other stories as well. In tomorrow's episode, Wes will be tracing a saddle to a veteran of Hollywood Westerns who helped change movie making. So it's always something new. Wes is president, principal auctioneer of Cowan's Auctions in Cincinnati. He is an internationally recognized expert in historic Americana. And in addition to his hosting on History Detectives, he's also a featured appraiser on the Antiques Roadshow. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller, Danny from the road. On the road. Hi, Danny. Oh, Deneen. Hi, Deneen.
It's Deneen, yeah.
Okay.
I thank you for taking my calls. I
sure.
just got chills as I was listening to you talk about the Manhattan Project. My mother-in-law was the secretary to Secretary of State James Burns during the war, and she carried that file for the Manhattan Project. And she actually typed the letter to Japan that told them that we had this bomb.
Whoa.
And she has quite a history. We still have the stenotype that she used. She came from a little town in Iowa, and she went to Washington to be a secretary, and she initially worked in the Pentagon before there was a roof over it, and then she was selected to be the secretary to Secretary of State James Burns, and she has all these amazing pictures. She went to Potsdam, and we have pictures.
I'm getting chills.
Really?
Just describing this story. This is a great story.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. She's done all kinds of presentations in her small hometown back in Iowa, and you know, she had this incredible experience, and then she went back to the farm, and here we have these wonderful photo albums that are just so amazing in history. And not too long ago, we were looking through one of her diaries that she had that wrote about some of these times, and we found this a handwritten piece of paper. I can't remember exactly what it said now, but it's signed HST, and I wish I had it in front of me that I could read it to you. We had given some of her history to representatives from the Truman Library, and so we called and said that we had this piece of paper. What should we do with this? And, you know, could we verify that it was written by Harry S. Truman? And they really didn't have a lot of information for us, but we looked at their photographs of other handwritten signatures of his, and it looks exactly the same. We don't really know where to go with it from there, but it's just, we just get chills every time we look at this stuff and go through it and think of the amazing history that she had.
Oh, yeah. I'm seeing a movie as you're talking about this. I'm seeing a documentary. How about you, Wes?
Absolutely. And again, warms my heart to hear you tell the story, because it only confirms my suspicions that everybody has a story.
Mm-hmm.
Every American's
yes.
got a story. The other thing that I thought was, you know, here you describe your mom as going back and working on the farm, which is what we all think about of the Greatest Generation, but we generally don't think of women as being part of that Greatest Generation. We're not that. Women haven't been celebrated nearly as much as men for their contributions.
Mm-hmm. How true. I always think about Frances Perkins in that regard. And
absolutely.
The huge contribution she made to the New Deal, and who can even identify who she is these days.
Exactly.
That's not right. Deneen, thank you so much for your call. That was a
great
call.
Great story.
Yes, it was. Jerry in Oconomowoc. Hi.
Good morning. I teach fourth grade, and you know, fourth grade teachers across the country all teach their state history. And for many of our students, it's the first time they they've really been introduced to history. Before that, they covered geography and community. So I'm curious what you think the most important thing we need to teach our students are.
Hmm. Boy, what a great question. And I appreciate the tough job that you and other teachers have, and what's the introduction. You know, I think, again, the key is getting kids engaged. And you're not going to get all of them engaged, but we need to find some way to get kids engaged. And, you know, maybe if you say, okay, kids, we're going to talk about Wisconsin history, and we're going to talk about this next week. What I'd like for you to do is to bring in a story about your family.
Yes,
that we can
great idea.
Talk mm-hmm. about your family. And maybe your family's history doesn't start until 1960, but it's still in Wisconsin, but it's still part of the history. Maybe your family started with, you know, fur traders in Wisconsin. But that I see as potentially an avenue to get at bigger stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks very much. Nothing like a history teacher. It's a good way to spend a life. Justin in Sheboygan. Hi.
Hi, good morning. My questions span like 80 years or so, so I apologize. One is the Manhattan Project and the Japanese sending the balloons up into the jet stream to drop ordnance over North America. And one of those balloons getting tied up in the power lines of one of the nuclear labs in the Southwest. And, you know, I've looked into it, and apparently it's pretty well documented. And it's just such a, for me, such a profound thing, this one lone balloon of all places finds itself wrapped up in the power lines and actually cuts power for some time to the lab. And I just found that fascinating. That would be a great thing. I don't know if you've heard of that, so I was hoping you could speak to that. The last question is regarding the Civil War. My reading of the Civil War is there was a practical nuts and bolts debate leading up to the Civil War, and it seems like our understanding really sensationalized to some degree. It's just a parody of that debate. Is there any hope either this generation or future generations might be able to tackle that debate? I mean, the practical problems that led up to the Civil War, or does it just not have the entertainment value to be considered in this age? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you very much, Justin.
Well, let's start with the incendiary balloons. History Detectives actually did a number of seasons ago a story about the incendiary balloons, and I'm not aware of ones being caught in power lines to a nuclear plant. It would have been, I would think, the closest ones it would have been would be to ones near the Hanford plant in Washington. I'm not aware that any balloons went as far inland as Los Alamos, New Mexico. That's a long way from the coast, but it's possible. I haven't heard that story. They weren't successful. We know that. Most of them never reached the United States. But History Detectives, and if you go on to the archives of History Detectives, I'm sure you can probably find that story. It was several years ago that we did a story. The Civil War, let's tackle that. That is such a great question, and I'm not sure that we'll ever get past the differences between North and South in terms of the ultimate causes of the Civil War. I think that there will always be people in the South who will say, you know, it really wasn't over slavery, it was over our economy and states' rights, all of which, in my opinion, are code words for we didn't want to don't mess with slavery.
Slavery, sure.
I would urge the viewer and any other viewer, however, to go to the library, download it on your Kindle, whatever you're doing, whatever electronic reader you're using. Get a new book by Adam Goodhart called 1861.
I've read it.
Civil
War
great. Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the middle of that book right now, and it is it's an amazing mm-hmm. book that looks at the real social history of what was happening in America. That really places a lot of this stuff into perspective. I mean, it's just a great book.
It is a great book. We had him on a couple months ago. You may want to archive that as well. Oh, I want to get to you, Phil, but can you tell the story in 30 seconds?
Hi.
Yeah,
a diary turned up in our family 12 years ago, written by a young woman in Delavan in the 2 years right before the Civil War. And there's some clues in there, like that maybe they were involved in the Underground Railroad.
Oh.
Like on the night of John Brown's raid, she writes in red. Which is the only place in the diary that she does that. Anyway, we met with a local historian, and he said he can't find anything about it. Of course, they're only a few miles from Milton, which was also referred to in the diary.
All right, scoot on over to the Wisconsin Historical Society is all I can say, and I wish we had more time with you. But
send
I think
the story into History Detectives.
There you go. Oh, good, good, good. Phil, we got a story. Send it to History Detectives, and you do that by going to...
PBS.org.
Okay. Wes, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And
thanks for having
great
me.
Fun.
I really appreciate it. Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night.
O'clock.
All right. 7, I think. Our,
7,
our
8, 7 Central. Thank you.
All right. That's okay. Wes Cowan, one of the history detectives, and the show, the new season starts tomorrow night at 7. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and for on-air production. Thanks for all of your wonderful calls.